Hey friends, it's Ron. Before we jump into our new year and new episode, let me suggest you start a new habit this year that I think will bless your marriage and family. My one-year devotional, Daily Encouragement for the Smart Step Family, was written to give couples a connecting point each and every day around a biblical or practical message for their family. In under 1 minute a day, the two of you can read aloud these devotionals and find encouragement to lead your home. Now, the new year has just started, so it's not too late to pick up a copy of Daily Encouragement for the Smart Step Family and get started. The show notes will tell you how to get your copy. Okay, on with the episode.
You've got to increase your understanding of autism, because if in your brain you keep saying this is a behavior issue, this is a discipline issue, you're not going to do things with the right intention. So as the family spider web grows, just in the family of origin can be issues, and then add in parents and step-parents and all of that, and you've got a lot of opinions about what's going on with this child.
From the Family Life Podcast Network, this is Family Life Blended. I'm Ron Deal. This donor-supported podcast brings together timeless wisdom and practical help and hope to blended families and those who love them. Well, welcome to the new year. It's episode 46, Autism and the Blended Family. Now, if autism doesn't directly impact your home, stay with us. I'm going to ask you to keep listening anyway, because I guarantee you there will be someone in your life who could benefit from this podcast or what you learn from it. So please hang with us. As I said, it is the new year, and we've got a new app for you. I know you're already listening to the podcast, but now you can listen through our new and improved Family Life app. And at the same time, you get access to transcripts, content links. You can even take notes while you listen. Plus, the app gives you access to all the podcasts in the Family Life Podcast Network, free downloads, devotionals like I do every day. And later this year, there's going to be more coming, like little short videos to enrich your marriage and family, online courses, personalized assessments. So while you listen today, go to your app store and search Family Life. That's all one word, Family Life. Did you know that 1 in 68 children have autism? Did you know that 1 in 20 children have a sensory processing disorder? And according to the CDC, 1 in 6 children have some form of learning disability and some form of developmental disability. Dr. Stephanie Holmes is a professional counselor. She's an ordained minister, an author, a speaker, and a certified autism specialist. But her real credentials come from being a mother to an amazing young adult on the autism spectrum. She wrote a book about all this, Confessions of a Christian Counselor, How Infertility and Autism Grew My Faith. It's quite a testimony to what she has learned. Stephanie counsels, consults, and coaches families with a person on the autism spectrum, and she works with what's called neurodivergent couples. That is when one of the partners has autism. Her passion is to help couples and families not just survive, but thrive. Here's my conversation with Stephanie Holmes. Okay, Stephanie, as we get started, you know, I'm mindful that we have people listening who are in a blended family with a child or a family member that has autism. I'm mindful that we have people listening that are friends, family members, a pastor, somebody who's just interested in supporting a blended family with a person with autism. So let's just start by looking at some terms and trying to understand language, because even I have questions from time to time about, oh, okay, the language has changed. So for example, what is AS? What is ASD? And what happened to labels like Asperger's syndrome?
Okay, very good question. So Asperger's came to us in the DSM-4 in 1994.
Let me just pause for a second. So DSM, Diagnostical Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. For those that are listening, going, what's a DSM? That's a big book that we counselors use to be able to bill insurance, is what that really amounts to. And it has to do with categories of mental and emotional and relational problems that people have. So it unifies the mental health field, just like medical doctors have terminology for to describe certain diseases. There are certain words that we use in the mental health field to talk about different things and to be able to unify insurance and medical professions. Okay, good. Back to where you were.
So back to that big book. It was Burgundy back then in 1994. And I happened to be in school. I was in my master's degree in what used to be called abnormal psychology, which we don't call it that anymore. But in the 1994 version, Asperger's was introduced to kind of broaden autism spectrum. Most of what people understood came from maybe Rain Man or classical autism or Kanner style autism, which tended to indicate autism with mental impairment or maybe nonverbal, non-speaking individuals. And we lost this research during World War II by Hans Asperger. He was doing some research. There's a whole backstory to that, but he was doing some research on some boys that he noticed had autistic features, but they were, quote, higher functioning. They didn't have intellectual impairment. In fact, they had exceptionalities. And so he was kind of researching, like, how broad is the spectrum? But they were written in a different language. That hospital got bombed during the wars, and it took 30 years for that research to emerge, get translated, and then get introduced as Asperger's, which then changed to high functioning autism. And then we've since morphed in our newer book, the DSM-5.
So if you're listening right now and you're thoroughly confused, welcome to the party. You know, this is the ongoing process of refining our understanding of difficulties when they arise and what happens and how we wrestle and how we, again, talk about, you know, mental, emotional, and relational difficulties in people's lives. So if you're confused, it's understandable. Today, we typically go by AS, which is autism spectrum, or ASD, autism spectrum disorder. Is that right?
It is. And I'm going to add some more layers because this is why it's so hard sometimes to diagnose. When we came out with a new book, the DSM-5, they decided to break up autism into autism level 1, autism level 2, and autism level 3. And so instead of describing the disorder by simply the criteria, it's actually described level 1, 2, and 3 by how much support that person needs. So a level 1 would be equivalent to what used to be called Asperger's and high functioning. So autism level 1 would require some support. Level 2 requires substantial support, and level 3 requires very substantial support.
Okay. Again, pretty subjective categories there, but that's an attempt to just try to help us understand what's required with a person with autism and how you come around them and what they need. So beyond all, that's all the nitty-gritty diagnostic statistical stuff. Let's just talk around the experience, all right? Because I think that's where people live. So a person with autism, what are some of the typical behaviors that we would see in that person?
Okay. So autism did get reclassified as a kind of neurodevelopmental disorder or issue because it shows up in developmental norms. Something is tracking along. Maybe a parent says, something is not quite the same. This child at age 2 or 3 or 4 was doing this, and this child isn't quite doing that. Or your around peers, play groups, and your child's just not quite fitting in or tends to be over to the side or only wants to do what we call in psychology parallel play versus interactive play. Not really interacting and communicating with the group, but happens to be there kind of doing something similar. But when you really look close, there isn't really a social engagement and connection. So I actually pulled out the DSM because in this community, we've got to be very careful to describe the behaviors diagnostically incorrectly, because the community in itself is very divided on if this is a gifting, if this is a disorder, if this is neurodivergency, or if this is a medical issue. So
let me just pause you there. So what you're saying is even family members with a person who has autism even disagree about how we should think about it. And the language that they use somehow puts people into different camps. Is that what we're saying?
Absolutely. Because yeah. You can have the autism as a gift and God made them this way camp. You can have autism as a diagnosis and it is a result of the fall, just like any other diagnosis camp. You can have, let's try to find treatments and protocols to help this child. And you can have, well, they have autism, so they're just going to be this way. Why are we investing money? And that can be two biological parents having that discussion.
Yeah, and having some disagreement about that, which I'm sure can lead to some difficulty between the two of them. Because if one of them's seeing it as a gift, then that's something you want to encourage. You wouldn't ever really want to detour what you're seeing. But if the other one sees it as something that needs some repair or some adjustment, or I'm not sure how they would verbalize that, then all of a sudden you're working in two totally different directions.
And that's usually the first kind of point of pressure for any family. Well, I actually back up. Whether or not to get a label or diagnosis, especially in the Christian church, tends to really struggle with labels and diagnostics and speaking things out in the atmosphere. So the first argument is we see something different. Do we want to move forward with some kind of diagnosis? That can be explosive. And then the diagnosis comes. What does that mean to each person in the family? And then add in grandparents and extended family on what they're observing. You spank it out of them, or you use carrots and sticks. Well, you know, this is a discipline issue. This is a neurological issue. So as the family spider web grows, just in the family of origin can be issues. And then to your audience of blended families, add in a whole nother set of family and parents and step parents and all of that. And you've got a lot of opinions about what's going on with this child.
Absolutely. And to the listener, we're going to get into that here in just a few minutes. What if the other home has a different point of view about this? What if they're treating things differently than you, and you're working with perhaps even a professional who's giving you guidance? But then, yeah, we're going to get into all of those kind of uniquenesses. So let's just use layman's terms. Some of the things that are common for somebody who is on the autism spectrum: rigid routines, you know, intense focus, maybe struggles to connect interpersonally, as you were saying. That can even show up developmentally in children. They're not really engaging with another child in terms of their play. They're just kind of in their own little world doing their own thing. May have some behavioral challenges, speaking, not speaking, and I'm sure you can give some more examples. And then not adapting well to change. Are those the most common things that you would see with somebody with AS?
Those are definitely the most common, and it's that social interaction across multiple contexts, home, school, church. The transition can be different from person to person, but also the child has some sort of sensory issue, and it can be extreme. It can be someone who's really aversive, well, that's kind of the stereotypical, what we see on television shows that are now the kids who cover their ears, the kids who hide, the kids who can't handle sirens or things of that nature. But you can have sensory seekers, which look ADHD, but they're not ADHD. They are seeking stimuli. Their brain isn't taking in enough. And so they're touching things and feeling things and licking things and doing socially inappropriate things to try to get more input. And so that looks very different from the one who is hiding and ducking and the one who's like might get away from you because they saw something really exciting and you're in a crowd and the school would say eloped or escaped from you. What did they see that was so exciting that they're trying to get the stimuli, which to a parent or a grandparent may look like disobedience, disrespect, and not following rules and protocols?
Yeah. So, again, there's a spectrum here, and I want our listener to get that. I mean, you may have encountered in your own family or in someone else's family an AS child or family member who is really high functioning, and it's just a couple of things about them that just seem a little odd or off is the way some people might describe it. Stephanie, is that a good? There's something about them. I'm not quite sure.
Something's
about
just different.
Yeah, not sure what that is. But at the other end of that spectrum is someone who has great difficulties, and behaviorally, it's very clear that they're in a different place. And so, again, the point you're making is that people can disagree about what they do about it, how they respond to that person, in particular, if it's a child.
Mm-hmm. And having those discussions, because once the diagnosis comes, which is not cheap, usually is not covered by insurance because autism falls in this gray area. It's not medical. It's not mental health. And so when you go for a psych evaluation or a full evaluation, it can cost $1,500 to $2,000. And that doesn't tend to get covered. So there's that. Do we do this? What is the importance of getting a diagnosis? Now we have it. Now what are we going to do about it? Where that person is, level one, two, or three, you can't treat it or cure it. So you think about, what are the skill deficits we can work on? We can maybe, if social skills training is the most important, then maybe that's a protocol. For the kids who are really sensory seeking or aversive, you can get occupational therapy. If the child is struggling with gross motor skills or fine motor skills, you might need to invest in physical therapy. So it's kind of where that child is. And then the way the DSM describes it is at different transitions, they might reach the level of the strategies or compensatory skills they have. Now with the new transition, we've got to look at a new set of skills that this person's going to need. And so all of those things are very expensive. They're limited by insurance. And so that's another place, like in our family, when my daughter was diagnosed, she had social skills, PT, OT, and cognitive behavioral therapy to deal with her anxiety. Then we had to have a pediatric psychiatrist to manage meds. That's five people and five appointments every week with five copays.
That is a lot to think about, to manage, and to process. I'm glad you brought up your daughter, because obviously you're a professional who specializes in working with families with an autistic family member, but you're also a mom, and you've walked this journey, and your family together has and is walking this journey. Do you mind just, I'd like to just take you back for a minute. What was one of the first indications there was just something a little different about your daughter?
It's interesting at first because I was a clinician already. I had finished school. I was an LPC in North Carolina at the time. And I did note how she lined things up constantly. So in my clinical brain, I'm thinking obsessive compulsive disorder. We do have this in our family. We need to nip this in the bud. But there was a lot of arranging, sorting, classifying, which is a little different for a three-year-old to be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not normal for a three-year-old to line their dolls up by the color of their dresses on the rainbow and the hue and saturation of colors in their dresses. I thought, well, she's really intelligent, a little precocious.
Very artistic. But, this kid's going to be a genius.
Exactly. I'm thinking this is a good thing. As she got into like preschool and elementary school, those differences, what I thought first was maybe anxiety or genius, which she does have a genius level IQ, but that was no longer a good explanation for what was going on with her and her peers, what was going on with her and the teachers, the behaviors that would be transition time. They would say, she's like, great until lunch, and then after lunch, she falls apart, and that's when they start doing more structured things. It was kind of free play in centers and welcome to class, and then we eat lunch, and then after lunch is some more structured things. And while she loves structure in general, it was that transition from free time to structure time. And then don't even talk about nap time. Eventually we were kicked out of the preschools. Like, you cannot, she leads the nap rebel brigade every time. she says, no nap, no nap. Then everybody's standing and tossing their sheets. So she was the only one with verbal skills.
You know, here we are kind of laughing about it now, but at the time, I'm sure you weren't laughing. You were baffled. You were concerned. You were, what does this mean? How do we help this child? What do I do? Feeling powerless?
Yes. I mean, at first there was a little bit of, I just have a super smart child and how to handle this, because in her class, she was the only speaker. She was speaking at 9, 10 months.
Wow.
So she kind of had power in the class, because amongst the 2 and 3 year olds, she was the only one that spoke. So they kind of like followed her around. So I thought, this is just a gifted child in the wrong class. It really became a problem when she entered elementary school. And I could tell she couldn't handle big classes. There was something just from going to Sunday school and church. It's like something about a lot of students does something to her. So we looked for a really tiny Christian school, which had its pros and cons. The pros was good one-on-one interaction, small classroom setting, small environment, lack of understanding in autism. She started what the teachers call eloping, which means escaping. Something would happen, there'd be a sound. The school was on a two-way highway out in the country. So when she escaped, she was escaping towards the road. That was a problem. If someone wanted something of hers from her desk, that would result in a physical aggressive act because she's very protective of her stuff, her desk, her space. And she really struggled with sharing and someone being in her space. So that was seen as disrespectful. I didn't know they used paddling at the school, but she would be paddled for such a thing, which would then also lead to what's commonly referred to as a meltdown, which the school thought was a tantrum. A meltdown is different. It's a neurological thing that's happening with your fight or flight system. The person really feels like they're in danger. And for all of us, we retreat and flight or we come out and fight. And she's a fighter.
She's a fighter.
So yeah. When she would have those moments. And so eventually we were asked to leave the Christian school. Her elementary school, from preschool to elementary school to about first grade, she had already been through four schools. And by the time we got to public school, there was the demand for some kind of testing.
Okay, so let's just go inside your heart and your marriage for a minute, if you don't mind talking around that. Like, what was going on there? The questions, the how you talked about this as husband and wife, and just the sense of helplessness. How did you manage that?
That part was very difficult to navigate. And we're open about this, and I've shared this in the book. So for everyone listening, I'm not talking behind my husband's back. But we really disagreed at the beginning because he saw it all as more gifts and exceptionalities, that we just hadn't found the right environment that understood her. My clinical background kept pinging that burgundy book, Asperger Syndrome, Asperger Syndrome, Asperger Syndrome. And there wasn't anything written hardly at the time, except for that one diagnostic book. So he tends to be a more frugal person with the budget. And so the financial piece was very difficult. And then is it an exceptionality or is it something that needs to be worked with? I ended up making a unilateral decision to move forward with testing. Part of his disagreement was the cost. And at that point in time, we did not have the money to move forward. So in North Carolina, there is a place you can go for free testing. They don't do that anymore, so I'm not going to mention it. But at that time, they had free testing. And I got on a wait list and then was able to satisfy that and satisfy an argument. It cost us nothing. But then once the label came, we again had two different opinions on what we were going to do. He was, let it play out, she'll grow out of it. And my mindset clinically is, we know it, now let's start a treatment plan and let's start moving things in proactive steps so that she can be as successful as she can be at whatever level that means for her. And so that was very tense for all of elementary school.
Okay, so let me just ask this question to everybody who's listening right now who does not have a family member with autism. What do we need to know? If we were near the two of you, you and your husband, walking through that season of your life, what could people around you have done to be helpful, and what should we not do?
Let me start with the not helpful. So we have always been a part of a church community, and in fact, the church we went to, my family was the founding members of. So we had been there a really long time. We met at church, met in youth group. So we had the same church community. Unfortunately, the church then and now does not really understand autism. I belong to a Pentecostal faith, so there were some who saw it as demon possession or demon oppression. Some saw it as Danny and I must have done something to sin, so we brought a curse onto our life. some of our teachers at the church saw it as a discipline problem. So it would be very common after I would pick my daughter up from Sunday school or children's church, I got given Dare to Discipline, The Strong-Willed Child, Shepherding Your Child's Heart, and some Amish book where it says, like, if your child bites you, you should bite them back. And all of these were seen as behavior and discipline issues instead of hearing me that this is autism. And if we could follow some protocols, and if you could help me, I'll help you. I want to be on your same team. I don't want her to have this behavior as well. But neither is the answer sending her to me to sit in big people church when she also needs to grow in Christ. She also needs discipleship.
And you can't parent AS out of a child any more than you can parent COVID-19 out of somebody who has the virus, right?
Absolutely.
And so if somebody is stepping in from the outside, adding pressure on you guys, saying, this is what you need to do, I have the solution, I have the answer, that just ramps up the stress internally, I would think, within your marriage and your family.
Absolutely, because then it does start causing those discussions on discipline. And what do you do, and time out versus corporal punishment versus rewards. And it's, my house turned into, it looked like an institution. There were charts everywhere, daily charts, weekly charts, monthly charts, targeting this behavior. I mean, I have a cognitive behavior background. I worked with children with problematic behaviors. Mm-hmm. So we were going to turn it around and do it 24/7. And it caused my husband to retreat for a while. He shared when we spoke together at an AACC conference, the American Association of Christian Counselors, they used to do one called Marriage and Family. And we spoke together, and he shared, as a dad, it was really hard because dad wants to fix things. And he was struggling with, how do I fix this? And did we cause this? And, you know, treatments and protocols are making things better, but it's not still right. And so he struggled a lot, and as he felt he couldn't do anything but pray, which is important, there was kind of a retreat in space during that period, because he didn't know how to engage, didn't know what to do to engage, and we saw things very differently in form of discipline during those really difficult years.
Did the two of you eventually bridge your gaps in terms of your definition of what's wrong here and come together and then start moving forward?
It kind of took an enemy of the enemy is my friend situation. Yeah. We got to a place when she was in third grade where, because the public school system didn't know what to do, they started trying to turn the problem on me and tried to get me classified as Munchausen's by proxy, which, for those who don't know what that means, it means someone with a mental illness who needs so much attention, they have created an illness in a family member so that they can have attention from authority or doctors or whatever.
Yeah, that, just a word for our listener there. Essentially, they were blaming you, Stephanie, for what was going on with your daughter, saying you need her to act this way. And so you are essentially emotionally or psychologically poisoning her such that she is bearing the symptoms of your need to have somebody to care for. And so they came after you.
They did. They sent the school psychologists in after me. We lived in North Carolina at the time. The capital's Raleigh. So we lived in the Charlotte area. There were people from Raleigh that came down. There were people from all over our county, from the county officials. There was over 20 people in this school meeting. And I felt very outnumbered. So I had one advocate, and my husband came with me. And I think when he saw what they were trying to railroad us in, basically what the school wanted to do was blame me for Munchausen's by proxy, and they wanted our custody removed from our child.
They were taking your daughter away.
Absolutely. They wanted to put her in an institution, essentially make her a ward of the state. And they said, when I had gone through treatment and I was a better parent at 18, if she decided she wanted to still be in relationship with me, that would be the course of action. So we had a trauma bond.
Yes, you did. You know, she was in, your daughter's in third grade, so she's seven, eight.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's 18, so you're thinking 10 years, they're wanting to put her in an institution, and then maybe she can come back to you if finally you've straightened up. And so, yeah, you and your husband had a new common enemy at that point. And so that's what brought you together in terms of how you moved forward. First of all, I know all that didn't happen. I'm thankful. I don't know that we have time to chase the whole story there, but can you sum up real quickly why none of that happened?
We moved out of that district and state. So the brief story is when they couldn't do that, there was actually an instance where my child was physically abused at school. And then when I brought it up, they wanted to then pin that on my husband. And then they wanted to try social services avenue in to take our child. So we knew we had to get out of the system. So we took fourth grade to homeschool and figure out where are we going to go. And then we moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and we researched what school district we needed to have our child in. And then from middle school on is a completely different story. The end of the light at the end of the tunnel, the hope, is she's 21, she's completed college, and she's going to grad school in the fall. So once we got the support we needed from the school, things turned around differently, and it changed the stressors in our family. It changed the family dynamic. It was night and day. Having a school and a church all supporting us in a community.
That sent you down a path of specializing in working with AS and ASD and families. And just to the listener, a few years ago, you and I teamed up and we wrote an article together on blended families where there has a family member with AS. And that was published in Autism Magazine. By the way, we'll put that link in the show notes for those of you that would like to download that PDF. By the way, to your knowledge, had there ever been something written on autism and blended families, that combination?
In 2016, when I reached out to you and I kind of cornered you at the conference, I mean, at that point, there really hadn't been anything from autism, blended family, and faith.
Yeah.
I think I found three or four maybe articles written from parents' point of views or church point of views, but not from a professional clinical point of view.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why has this not received more attention?
I think with autism, it's what whoever will give me an ear to hear is sometimes there's a lot of great things out there. Like if you're talking about school inclusion, church inclusion, blended families, marriages, teenagers, there's a lot of great things out there, but it's slightly different once you put autism in the picture. And so sometimes they're the, well, just take the materials that are out there and you tweak them.
Yeah.
You just tweak them how you need to fit autism. And it's like, well, that works great for me as an individual clinician. But if we could take all of these broad areas that we have in the counseling and mental health field and start just adding that different layer in, it would create broader resources. But that's kind of what, it really was not my intention to specialize. Honestly, truly, once I got my daughter through high school, I was like, this is it. I'm done being in the autism world. I can't function. I want to go back to marriage and family and doing what I was doing. And she doesn't remember this, but she's the one that came to me with the plea as she got into high school. There were a lot of kind of the misfit kids that weren't allowed to be in social circles. And she was telling me they were undiagnosed or how their family treated them, or they were in step family situations where one of the parents didn't like them. And she's like, there's not very many voices who advocate for us.
Wow.
And I was like, well, God can raise up an army, sweetie. And she was like, I think you need to be the head of the army. And I was like, okay, we'll pray about it. And that kind of switched because once I wrote a couple of articles and put them out there, I could no longer ignore the demand from the calls and the tears and the emails. Please come speak to my church. Please come speak to this college. And so it really showed me there was a big, an empty space there. And then, based on what we were talking about in my own family, the divorce rate for families with children with autism is much, much higher.
That's right.
Which means they're going to possibly end up in a blended family, which means now we have more blended families with kids with autism.
Well, first of all, let me just say your journey into your expertise is very similar to my journey. I just did a few things, and then I couldn't ignore the demand or the requests for help. And it has led us both down the individual roads that we've been on. And then we merged a few years ago and just pooled some of our collective wisdom and wrote that article. And it's been really widely distributed. And I'm pleased that you're now with us. Let's turn the corner and let's get practical and talk about blended families, where they have a person with the AS diagnosis in them. We talk on this podcast quite a bit about when you're merging families, whether you both brought children or only one of you brought children or whatever the structure is of your family, you're merging cultures, you're merging traditions and histories and routines and parenting styles and money matters and lost narratives from the past, and on it goes. Then if you layer on top of that this whole reality of how the family has to adapt and hover around or center around the AS person, that just adds a whole nother element to how do we integrate? How do we merge? Step siblings who come alongside and go, I don't understand this person. Why do they do what they do? And all I did was took the crayon and they got mad and screamed at me. Like, so there's just this awareness level, those entry level, I don't know how to deal with this things, as well as the step-parent who comes on and just doesn't understand. They now have their own journey in trying to make sense and understand. And maybe they have a different point of view about what is really going on here. Is this a gifting or is this a, some sort of just a parenting matter we need to figure out? All of that merger of initial ideas and culture and experiences will just ramp up stress for blended families. How do they, what are your thoughts around, okay, we need to communicate around this? The people who have been dealing with this longer, the biological parent who's bringing the child into the new blended family, what are some tips on how they help others understand without it becoming a, I know and you don't, I'm the teacher, you're the student, or is that really ultimately probably what's going to happen?
Well, it's interesting because in your Smart Family series, I can't remember the number now. I was going to try to find it. I don't remember if it was 47 or 48 different types of blended families.
67.
Okay. All right. So I am way off. So there's almost the same type of divergencies or different combinations in your autism families because if you have a child with autism, JAMA last year said there's an 81% chance one of the parents is on the spectrum. Mm.
Okay, JAMA. All right. Explain who JAMA is.
JAMA. It's a medical journal. Sorry. It's a medical journal.
Journal of American
Medical Association.
Okay.
So they had in 2019, and for anyone who's into research, you'll know that a 2.1 million participant study is an extremely large study.
Oh, that's massive.
Across five countries in 5 years.
And what percentage of
81%
have a parent.
There's an 81% genetic link.
Wow.
And that's kind of how my ministry started, is a child on the spectrum got diagnosed and a parent or a grandparent or uncle or niece or nephew. Hmm. It starts coming in the family tree once the first diagnosis happens. So that might be one of the reasons that the marriage divorced. But now try to work with that parent who is also on the spectrum and has social relational problems and now stepdad and dad.
Mm-hmm. So let me paint a scenario. So biological mom bringing one or more children, one of them who has AS, into a new marriage, stepdad. He may have children of his own, so they're step-siblings trying to understand the step-sibling with AS. But you're saying in that scenario, could be biological dad has AS, he's in the other home. So his ideas about the child, his ideas about himself, if he's in a new marriage situation. So you have to figure out how to educate and bring as many people as possible on board with not only the explanation or diagnosis would be the clinical word, but how we're going to cope and help this child. That just adds—
while working with another adult who has social communication interaction theory of mind issues.
Yes.
Which made it difficult in the first place to be married and have a family of origin.
Yep.
Now that that person doesn't have the possibility of relationship to the wife or biological mother, can sometimes be a little obstinate in dealing with the situation.
So I can see the pressure being on in our little scenario, biological mother who's trying to help her new husband, stepdad, understand the history, all the things that she's tried through the years and how they've come to the understanding that they now have, trying to get him on board. There's no other way than for her to educate him, right?
Exactly. Because it's going to start to really, there's two major areas we're going to see is, well, I have an 8-year-old child and you have an 8-year-old child. And we thought they could share a room.
Right.
That's usually a bad idea. I mean, yes, you should teach children on the spectrum to share and all of that. But a lot of times children and teens on the spectrum, they do need a space to decompress where no one's touching their stuff. They can kind of keep that little universe as individualized as they want. And that can be a problem if you start sharing rooms.
Okay, Stephanie, let me play devil's advocate. I'm the stepdad. I'm sorry, are you telling me that we're going to treat her 8-year-old differently than my 8-year-old?
Exactly.
Are you telling me that my 8-year-old can't really learn to share and play with his stepbrother because of this AS thing, whatever that is? Are you telling me that we're going to have totally different standards, like my child's going to have chores and her child's not going to have?
Very possibly.
It just doesn't seem fair, Stephanie.
And that's the F word when I'm working with. I say it's the other 4-letter word we should never say.
That's a good point.
Because it is also not, quote, fair that this child has a neurological difference and a developmental delay or disorder. Now, of course, we want children to learn to share and interact well, but you can take neurotypically developing children and put them in a room and they can play. If you're going to have your 8-year-old and that 8-year-old and they're sharing space, that needs to be supervised and it needs to be a learning situation, right? You just can't send them in there and hope they're going to work it out, because that 8-year-old may be operating on an emotional level of a 4 or 5-year-old, an intellectual level as a 12-year-old, mm-hmm. and your biological 8-year-old is all 8 years old biologically, intellectually, and emotionally. That's two different children.
Absolutely. Let me mention a couple other practical things that we reference in that article that we wrote together. Number one, move slowly with transitions or big changes. Everything about becoming a step family is a big change, right? Sometimes moving into a different house, different schools, different community, different church. I mean, the ripples are many. Beyond the first initial big changes, try not to make other transitions in a quick, and what are your thoughts and guidance around that?
So as we were kind of talking about schools, if the mom or whoever the biological or custodian parent is, if they found a school that's working with them, and if miraculously, if they have found a church that supports them, the Baptist Convention and USA Today said that families with autism or special needs are the most unreached people group in the United States. There's hardly any churches that have special needs ministries or will work with. So if she's found a church that actually has a program for her child, it's not like you can get up and go to any other church and possibly find. So that might be another matter of contention. Maybe he doesn't like that church. Maybe his children don't like that church. And so it's like, but we have one member of the family who may only be able to have their spiritual needs met in one location in this entire city or state. So it's a little bit more difficult transition. Same thing with school. If she's found, and I'll use the IEP means individualized education program. When you have a special needs child, you go through a legal process of getting an IEP for your child. If you actually have a team that's working well with you and a school that has made the accommodations and adaptions, it's not simple to say, let's up and move. We need a bigger house. And so we can't afford this school district.
So everything you're saying right now, let me just make overt what you're saying. The AS person has an inordinate amount of power in your family system. So many things need to be oriented around them. Not that they're using that power. I'm not saying they're manipulative. I'm saying in order to provide the care, it's like having a family member who has Alzheimer's and is weak and feeble. Like, so many things have to accommodate around that. It's just true. And yet that can seem unfair, right? We're back to that, wait a minute. So we have to go to this church or remain in this school district for this child, but my child needs this, or my child would excel here, but we really can't make those choices. Those are hard.
Because it's with families that I work with, when the special need is obvious, like the child's in a wheelchair, has an amputated limb, is going through cancer treatment, mm-hmm. it's obvious. Yeah. There is an obvious need and reason, and it would be heartless to go to a church that didn't have wheelchair accessible ramp. That's an obvious thing. But when it's a hidden disability, like autism, and for everything else, quote, looks normal, mm-hmm. it's harder to see when these behaviors are related to autism. I mean, there can be autistic children who act like brats, and there can be parenting styles that enable bad behavior, because while you're using the word power, I do try to have the families understand the child with autism still should not become the sun in the family universe. Mm-hmm. You're still all, the marriage in the family is the sun, and we've got to figure out how to make everything revolve around. But for this member who has a lot more needs, we might have to make more modifications, accommodations, and be much more mindful in where we're going and how we're doing things.
That's a good word. Another practical thing that we talked about for step family members, a step parent, step siblings, you need to lower your bonding expectations for how close and how much affection and touch, how that's going to work with the person with AS.
Absolutely. I think in your materials, you share the average blend is 5 to 7 years. And you might never really feel blended or attached to this person, because the person with autism, based on how they bond, it may just be a bonding over task. So you may not feel connected to them. But let's say stepdad, I live in Atlanta, so let's say the little boy has an interest in the Braves, and the Braves game becomes your thing, like watching it on TV or going to a Braves game. That might be how you bond, is a task where you might not be feeling the cozy, warm feeling like I'm here with my son or stepson and we're all doing this together. But if that child is happy and squealing with the light and totally focused and zoned in, you get a residual bonding there. I was there with him, and that's our thing. Now, it becomes difficult when you want to add other children to that. Yes. It's like, no, this is our thing. I don't want the other kids there. So there's always complications, but your bonding might be in tasks or what we call restricted special interest. Kids on the autism spectrum will usually have a thing that they are super focused on: video games, horses, weather, astronomy. The more you learn about that and are willing to have those discussions, it helps them want to become more interested in your world, but you do have to enter their world first. And if you're kind of accepted in their world, then they're more interested in your world versus you forcing the outside world onto them.
And by the way, I'm just going to say that is a typical strategy we teach step families in general, period. Step parents, enter the world or the interests of your stepchildren, join them in those spaces, and then begin to move outward from there. With the person with autism, it's just going to be a longer road towards that end game. And it may not actually move beyond sharing of the interest, but it could. What we're saying is not lower your hopes or expectations. It's just reframe them and recognize that bonding is going to come in a different pathway, not necessarily the way it does in other relationships that you're used to. And I think the other piece here for, again, step siblings and step parents, step grandparents who are trying to figure out how to relate to the person with autism is, you know, don't take things personally. You know, it's not rejection necessarily. It's just the way that person is, and you do have to join them in who they are rather than expecting them to come halfway, maybe is what I'm trying to say, just like most friendships or relationships develop.
And it's really hard when there are multiple children in this family, and maybe the normal scenario for me is usually stepdad. Usually mom is the custodial parent. But stepdad is like the two or the three kids are like, "Whoa, on board, yay, we're so glad, you know, to have you." And then this child on the spectrum is either indifferent or keeps saying, "When's my real dad going to come home? When's my real dad going to come home? When's my real dad going to come home?" And that can feel hurtful.
Yeah, sure.
To hear.
If you don't understand where that's coming from, it just feels like rejection and you put it into the wrong category. And you have to, so what category should somebody put that in?
part of that person's need for rigidity, routine, and sameness. People on the spectrum like sameness, even when they're adults, even when they're grandparents. The sameness, routine, order is what helps reduce anxiety.
That's where comfort comes.
Knowing what's coming next, yes.
And so that's why avoiding big changes and dealing with transitions are going to be difficult times. So yeah, put it into that category in terms of that is something that they need.
And if you want to do something that's really difficult, so let's just say going to Disney World, that was a stretch goal for our family. Disney World is the most sensory assaulting place on the planet. But we had to think through, where are the potential meltdown moments? What are we going to do because child B should not get to go because child A is doing something? So how are we going to do this if there's a meltdown or there's a place this one can eat and this one can't eat? It has to be done with strategy and intent. You do not wing things with children with autism, but you can have plans. Yeah. Have plans, have noise-canceling headphones for the fireworks show. Bring sunglasses if they don't like how bright the fireworks are. We had like a bag of sensory stuff, and we had to kind of know at any point we could leave, and no one's going to be angry about it, and we'll figure out another strategy the next day. And so it can't be wrapped into personal feelings.
So again, I can hear how the biological parent of the person with autism certainly can understand it, comes to understand it. They have their own journey into understanding that, how to make sense of it, and then how to cope with it. And then the merging process into a step family involves the same thing. Everybody new has to have that same journey. And they may not see the wisdom that the biological parent is. And I could see how this creates a real imbalance. The biological parent kind of holds all the cards and the understanding. They know what to do. Everybody comes to them. And in some ways, I can see how that's good because they're enlightening and bringing others in on the journey. But at the same time, I can see how they've got to figure out ways, the biological parent, of bringing the step parent in on some decisions. So it's not always under your control. I can see how that would be the other side of balance here. I wanted to ask you this. One of the things that we teach in general, step parents, as you're bonding the first 2-3 years of connecting with a child, depending upon their age, sometimes more or less, we encourage them to really go light on punishment. They can be involved in discipline, that is structure, teaching, guidance, offering wisdom to a child, you know, that sort of thing. But when it comes to a consequence, you know, my general advice is biological parents ought to do that in the beginning because step parents haven't really earned the trust with the child to make that imposing of consequence really something the child learns from. It feels violating sometimes to kids. And so it's a journey to get to the place where you're able to offer discipline. What do you think about the step-parent coming in with a child who has autism? Should they refrain from that for an extended period of time? What do you think that would be like?
So there's a slight nuance there. If you have a child who maybe is working with an applied behavior analyst, an ABA specialist, it would be crucial for everyone in the house to do everything exactly the same consistently. So if there was an ABA therapist involved and now this person is going to be in the home and you're part of the family, the ABA therapist might say, you know, I need everyone doing it 100% of the time with the very same consistency. So sometimes that can be helpful.
Yeah. So in that case, the step parent is going to jump in and act just like the biological parent would act in any given situation.
But then there can be the disagreement, of course, on how necessary it is. Do I have to do it every time?
Sure.
But when you're doing ABA training, it's 100% of the time consistency, or you're back to square one, even though you did it 99 times in a row.
Yep.
That 100th time could send you back. So that part helps. And sometimes I would say to families when they're having that, why don't you employ an ABA therapist? Why don't you have this specialist help the two of you come to the same page? It equalizes it for the child. And let's throw the ABA therapist under the bus, so to speak. It's their rule. They're saying we have to do this. It's giving us a common language, and we're all working on a specific behavior. I'm going to help your child understand the impact of what's going on psychologically, but this therapist can really help outline the rules and get you on the same page mm-hmm. and increase that consistency.
And let me just point out that there's another nuance to this, because if the step-parent jumps on board with being consistent with the child with autism, they might not be able to fulfill that role with the other stepchildren who do not have autism or not on the spectrum.
Correct.
And so that can feel unfair again. And it's just true. There's certain relationships you can move forward with. By the way, that's not uncommon to our listener. I want you to hear that. Sometimes step-parents bond with really young children faster than they're bonding with the older teenage sibling. And so, yeah, you do feel more parent-like quickly with some kids than you do with other kids. That too is pretty common and understandable, and it is what it is. Let me ask you about something else, Stephanie. Talking with friend and colleague Shannon Simmons, who works on our team, and she pointed out something I thought that was just a really good observation. One of the other things that we try to help biological parents with as they're adapting into step-family life is that they need to not overjudge the step-parent's heart for their child. It's pretty common for parents to disagree from time to time. Why did you respond that way? I'm sorry, I don't really think can we talk about this? That's very common for all parents in any situation. But what's not common is, at least in biological families, is for one parent to judge the heart or intent, the goodwill towards the other biological parent about their child. Like, I trust you with my child, with our child, but I don't think we should ground them for 6 months. That's just too long, right? So let's talk about that. Sometimes what happens in step families is a biological parent really jumps on, I don't even trust you're trying to do good things for my child. You know, I'm judging your heart, not just the fact you grounded them for 6 months, but also why you grounded them. Well, I think a biological parent, you think it'd be true that there could be a trap here. If you've got a child with AS, the trap is you overjudge how other people respond. You judge their heart, their head, you don't understand my kid. And so there's this constant veto of who the step-parent is, who they're trying to be in the child's life, and what they do. Don't you think that would be a trap?
If you've heard of a mama bear, there's a whole different breed called autism mama bear.
Is that mama bear on steroids?
Absolutely.
Have you been
there? Because an autism mama bear has already dealt with a biological parent, school teachers, administrators, pastors, elders, all these people who said they had good intention, everybody who said they were giving you support, everyone who said they were on your same page, and continually undermined or did something they thought was helpful or better, because surely she didn't mean it when she said, don't look them in the eye. Everyone knows with children, you look them in the eye, not with AS kids, you do not. So I could see in the families that I work with, that's a hard piece for mom, because there are biological family members and grandparents who don't get it and don't follow the protocols and don't act with kindness. And you're asking me to trust you. I mean, yeah. I've known you a year, two, maybe three. You don't know my child. You don't know what it took to get to this point. Because you're always concerned about regression, and you're always concerned about losing skills, and you're always concerned about backsliding. So you do this one thing incorrectly, we might all be dealing with this whole new behavior for a lot longer, and we've worked 3 years in therapy on this.
Yeah, yeah. So that overprotectiveness probably isn't overprotective. It's the vigilance that is required in order to keep moving forward. I can totally see how that is experienced by the step-parent as controlling. You're controlling.
Absolutely.
You know.
Even in the family of origin, when one parent predominantly does the research and tends to be mom, but there might be role reversal. But I had more time. Yeah. I read more books. I had a clinical background. I went to every IEP meeting. I knew every teacher. I knew when every sub came. The other parent just usually doesn't have all that information. So even in a family of origin situation, just the constant updates, upkeeps, this is what's happening. This is the new piece to our puzzle. This is another piece of the equation. It's a lot of information.
So does Mama Bear have to consciously kind of turn herself down a little bit and not be, What word would you give to that person who's listening right now who's going, that's me. I'm trying to keep this thing moving forward and hold it all together, and I just have to be that way.
Well, I think it would help if the step parent would show some interest in some of the learning, because you've mentioned that the biological parent is already several years ahead of the journey. So now it's like we're on an on-ramp and the step family is coming in, but they haven't seen the first 5 or 10 years. They don't know the struggles it took to get there, all the steps, all the things we've overcome. So it's very easy to come in with one or two statements once you live together and be like, leave that kid alone with me for 2 days and he won't be doing that anymore.
Uh-huh.
Or
right.
This is crazy that you only let him eat dino chicken nuggets for lunch. You know, I'm going to show him how to eat other things. So when there are these authoritative statements that I know better than you, that's going to definitely hit the mama bear button, which doesn't usually go well. And then secondly, sometimes the step parents don't want to understand autism. And I'll say, get one book, watch some YouTubes. You've got to increase your understanding of autism, because if in your brain you keep saying this is a behavior issue, this is a discipline issue, this is unfair, you're not going to do things with the right intention. You cannot possibly do it with the right intention if you don't understand the child, their brain wiring, which cannot be undone or changed, and what it's going to take, you know, to work together as a family. So to really increase that element of teamwork, there's got to be some increasing of understanding of what autism is and isn't. And then for the mom, I would say, be open to some feedback, because maybe sometime this parent might get your child to do something you can't. Maybe a new situation and trying something in a different way might actually help build a different skill. So being open to another adult who is invested, is willing, might actually be an asset to a different skill.
Stephanie, I want to turn the corner to the other home for a minute, because everything we've been talking about between biological parents, step parent, working together, on-ramping, now we got another home. We alluded to that earlier, but let's just assume that there's not necessarily a biological parent with AS over in the other home. That's a complication. But let's just assume that there was some disagreement about how to parent the child. Perhaps that even led to the divorce. That may have been part of the breakup, the coming apart of the biological parents. Now there's another step parent in the other home. So it's kind of like all of this on-ramping, negotiation, talking, educating, coming together. Can we see this the same? Can we manage the child's behavior the same? Establish routines times two, because now we have visitation issue and the child goes to the other home and they don't manage the routine and they don't behave consistently as what we're learning to do, and things unravel. I've always emphasized to people how important co-parenting is to the emotional, psychological climate and a child's well-being. When there is war between the two households, between the biological parents, the child's caught, they're a prisoner of war. They're caught in the middle of that. Countless ways. Then you add to it all of these other layers of what the AS child needs. How does that negotiation between homes, what do they need? What can a parent be mindful of as they're trying to coordinate and cooperate with the other home?
So there's several things. We'll talk about maybe what I see is the most common, and this is going to be interesting, but let's say that the autism has been a part of it, the challenges, the parenting, and the biological father's like, the mother is just too controlling and tries to keep even maybe the new wife and the ex-wife from meeting. She's so controlling, just wait till you meet her. She'll be in everything. Oddly enough, once the child with autism is in the other home, who do you think more than likely does more research on autism? The new stepmom or the biological dad? The stepmom.
Yeah.
So she gets on YouTube, she gets some books, and now she starts to get her husband to read the same things that the biological mother
Wait,
tried to get
ironic
him on
moment.
Board.
Just got to take that in.
Yes.
Such an ironic moment, right?
It's like, maybe mom isn't controlling as we thought.
Yes.
And I think I'm seeing where this went awry, because that step parent who may have children as well, is trying to figure out how do I keep, I'll go into their brain for a minute. How do I keep my child safe from that meltdown?
Yes.
How do I stay safe in the car if he starts kicking and screaming and kicks my hand and moves it off the gear shift?
And what do I do? And how do I manage and keep this home safe? Absolutely. So they're motivated all of a sudden to learn something. And sometimes brain, so have you seen that be a game changer for that biological parent who prior was just saying, you know, my ex is controlling, but now they actually come up to speed?
They don't want to be a two-time divorcee. So sometimes now hearing, because now that mom is a mama bear, and she's like, if this is going to work out, when our kids are here, either you've got to discipline this child better, or you've got to figure out something, because it's one thing when it was in your own house. It's a different thing that you're exposing my children to this. So now she has a little bit of leverage to say, we're going to get help or counseling or protocol or something to help us when he is here. Or she will say, I don't want him here. And then that causes a bigger issue. Your daughter, your other children can come, but that child is not welcome here. That's a big game changer. And sometimes that's what happens, unfortunately, to my sad little children, is dad says, I'm not learning anything about it. So, okay, mom, he's just can't come. Send the other ones over. All right, now what we've created is my brother and sister's going and I can't go. So tantrum over here, meltdown over here. There's peace over here, but we didn't really resolve the problem. So the step parent in that situation is also very, very vital to the teamwork.
Yeah, so if you're the biological parent and you're concerned about the cooperation with the other home and you have a poor negotiation history with your former spouse, maybe the thing to do is to try to build an alliance with the new step-parent in the other home. And that's another layer of sacrifice, perhaps. Maybe you don't necessarily like who that person is for whatever reason, but learning to put that aside in order to cooperate on behalf of the child is a good way to go.
Absolutely.
By the way, I could see the opposite end of that spectrum, that scenario you painted. I can see if there's a high degree of cooperation between former spouses and they do talk and they do say, okay, what's, you know, how do we work together? And they do have a history of that. I can see new step parents coming into the scenario going, wow, you guys talk a lot, you and your former ex. And that may feel like a threat to our marriage and our household. And again, I would encourage you to make the distinction. Is this personal, relational, romantic stuff that's going on between the two former spouses, or is it just parental stuff? If it's parental, I know it requires a good deal of time and effort and talk and cooperation and kindheartedness toward one another, but that doesn't translate into romance. So as long as you trust that that boundary is not being crossed, get on being part of the team rather than someone who inadvertently is an antagonist to their ability to cooperate.
And I mean, I've set in IEP meetings because sometimes what I do is an advocate. So now that I don't have a child in the school, I may go advocate on behalf of someone else. And so oftentimes, biological dad, biological mom, and a step parent or two. And when everybody's on the same page, it's a glorious thing. When the two men in the room are the dads that are not on the same page actually complicates the IEP process because I don't really think the child needs this. Well, we can see this in our home we don't see that. And so if we're not all on the same page, you got to be divided is not good in an IEP meeting. Everybody's got to be on the same team. So then you have that now painting the picture that you've painted. The biological parents have been on the same page. They're doing the same protocols. I'll just give you a common protocol, might be gluten-free, dairy-free diet, OT, PT, certain sensory things, and both parents are into that. Okay, now, new stepmom, why are we spending all that money on that? You're telling me we can't afford dance classes for Sally, but I'm noticing we spend $400 or we're splitting the cost on all these therapies for your son. That's not fair. And I have to keep retraining, stop saying fair, say equal, say what's needed. A 10-year-old and a 5-year-old also have different needs. We don't treat a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old the same. We have different expectations based on where they are developmentally. We got into that same thinking with autism. It is a developmental disorder or delay. So you have to treat that child where they are developmentally and whatever they need to develop we're giving that to them. And oftentimes that may mean in the budget sacrifices to other events. And that is another tension spot in the family. Finances are already tough topic to discuss in marriage. But now when somebody is taking a bigger piece of the pie and it's obvious, that creates tension.
I love the way you said that. Stop saying fair. Start asking what's equitable. What's equal in terms of what's good and right and appropriate for this child and developmentally where they are. That's really good. I want to hit on just a couple more things. Let's come back to this blended family couple who's listening right now, and their life is touched by a person with autism. And how do they keep their marriage strong in the midst of all these stressors and all these conversations that have to take place? In our article, again, you can reference that in the show notes if you'd like to download that PDF. We give some suggestions. I'd love to just run through these real quickly and maybe have you, Stephanie, comment on one or two that you've seen have really made a difference for people. Let me just hit these. Get rooted in your faith together as a couple. Avoid being defensive about your child. Try to find time to dance and dine as a couple, spend time together, date, and, you know, really nurture your relationship. Step-parents need to learn patience. Step-parents need to learn organizational skills as it relates to the person with autism. Find joy in the small victories and just try to work towards preventing meltdowns from happening. Is there one or two of those that just kind of rises to the top for you?
I would say the two most important is if dating and your marriage was important before, it is extremely important now, which ties into having a community. You cannot go out to eat if you don't have a babysitter or family member or church member who knows about AS, who knows how to work with. We found no babysitter that we could pay enough to babysit. So if we didn't have a grandparent, and they were all usually willing to be on board and protocols, but that's different in the step or the blended family. And if you've moved away from family, your extended family. So even more important to have a community, like a faith community, and finding someone who can help care for that child so you can get a respite, because you need dates away and you will need weekends away together without any children, so you can actually speak to each other as adults and not discuss protocols and autism and what child did whatever. So I would say it really makes it important, but that's going to tie back to having that community, because you need a village to raise a child on the spectrum. And the second thing that I say to pastors, teachers, and step parents is you cannot get offended. You cannot get engaged in that lack of eye contact. They spit on my shoe. They turn their back at me, and calling all that disrespectful behavior, because I will react differently to someone I think disrespected me than I think someone who has a neurological brain wiring issue. If I think you did it on purpose, my Enneagram says I'm going to have to take you out. But if I think you did that not to hurt me and you're motivated by your own brain wiring, you have more mercy and grace to give when you go, oh, this is autism and that's about them. It's not about me. But that's hard to keep yourself emotionally regulated, to not when they're, I don't want you. I just want my dad. I don't want you here. I hate you here. The verbal vomit that could come out, the filter's gone, and everything they're feeling or thinking in that moment is going to come out. And if you try to teach them, stop them, don't speak to me that way in that moment, it's going to turn into a full-blown meltdown. So that's why understanding and knowing it and how to deal with that meltdown, then you have your teachable moment 20 minutes later when everybody is in a calmer, emotionally regulated state. Then we do the teaching and the this is how this was not appropriate or acceptable.
You talked a little bit about having a community around you. And earlier we talked a little bit about churches. I'm imagining somebody right now, blended family listening to us right now. Boy, this is our life. We desperately need our pastor, our friend, our Sunday school teacher, our small group leader. I need my grandma to listen to this podcast. And now at this moment, grandma is listening to the podcast. What would you say to those people? What else would you say to them about what they can do to be supportive, to be a part of the community that's helping this couple raise their child?
So the number one thing we go back to, I think, is understanding autism, which is harder for the older generation. If I've heard this once, I've heard it 1,000 times. We didn't have ADHD and autism back in my day. It's all newfangled. I was like, no, there was a lot of kids just getting beaten. So there's the understanding that this is a real diagnosis and understanding it. Second, less advice giving and more, how can I help? They may not feel comfortable being with the child with autism, and I think that's fair, especially if my daughter was aggressive for about 5 years. So I wouldn't want to put someone in harm's way when she was in her hitting, biting, scratching phase. But can I get groceries for you? Because you can imagine going to the store sometimes with a child on the spectrum is not fun. We had a rake the glass jars moment, you know, once. So just saying, can I run the groceries for you? Or can I take Sally for you so that you and Johnny have to work this out? Offering different things to be helpful. Is there a service or something I can do? Can I take the other kids sometimes without being like, I'll take them all but that one? But, you know, is there something I can do when I'm taking my children? Can I add Sally here too? Would that be helpful? And asking the parents what they need. What would be helpful to support you? What are some things you wish you can do that if another able-bodied adult was here, you might be able to do? And just, and listening. And they might say, you know what? There isn't really anything you can do because, I'll just use my daughter's name. Sydney's just too aggressive right now. I don't want her to kick you or hit you right now, but I really would just like you to let me talk about it sometimes and understand my frustrations and that I'm not a bad mom because sometimes I'm really frustrated and I want to squish her. I love her with all of my heart and you won't be able to say anything bad about her or I'll take
That's
you
right.
out. But sometimes I need to vent.
I can talk bad about my child, but you cannot talk bad about my child.
Right. Right. I need to vent and have a safe space where you're not trying to fix my problem, while you're not telling me what to do, you're not giving me another daggum book, but just saying, wow, that's hard. What can I do then to support you? And what could I read? What could I understand? That's a gift in and of itself, just to know one person understands and will let me be me and let me lower my shoulders down and go, I gotta tell you, you won't believe the thing my child did today.
Yeah.
Without being like, well, that was my kid. I always told you you should do this. When that happens, you've lost your safe space.
Right. Put the judgment away. Be a community that loves and comes alongside and be a safe place. That is such a good word. Of course, we need to do that in around 1,000 different things as the body of Christ for one another. But this certainly is another one. I want to ask you one last question. Stephanie, you make a real distinction. You say, AS is not itself a, quote, gift, but the person with AS is a gift. Why is that distinction important? You've been listening to my conversation with Stephanie Holmes. I'm Ron Deal, and this is Family Life Blended. We'll hear Stephanie's response to that question in just a few minutes. But before that, I need to ask you to do something for me. Please, please, please share this episode or perhaps the article that Stephanie and I wrote together. Share it with a friend. Somebody can benefit from this episode. To our knowledge, that article is one of the first and only articles ever created for blended families with an autistic family member, and that makes this podcast only the second resource available. Someone in your world needs to hear it. Please share it with them. Well, maybe you've got your New Year's resolutions figured out already, but I want to suggest one. May I suggest that you pick up a copy of my one-year devotional, Daily Encouragement for the Smart Step Family, and start reading that together each day. Now, here's the thing. If you're like me, you're thinking, ain't nobody got time for that. Well, that's why I designed these to be read in under a minute. That's right, less than 1 minute a day. That's all it takes. But I think the results can be lasting. The conversations it will spark between the two of you, the unity you will find together in parenting, and the warmth that I hope it engenders in your heart towards one another, I think that's well worth a minute a day. So think about it. Daily encouragement for the Smart Step family. Check the show notes for more information. If you want more information about my guest, you'll find that in the show notes as well. Or you can just check it out at the Family Life Blended podcast page at familylife.com/podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to check out everything Family Life has for your marriage and family, familylife.com/podcasts. We heard from Teresa on Instagram. She says, I've been listening to your podcast for about a month now. I have three stepdaughters. These messages have helped me feel understood, given me some new ways to think about our family and continue to seek the best for them. Thanks for the work you do. I passed this on to a few friends and they have been blessed as well. That's pretty cool, Teresa. We appreciate that. You can also rate us or write a review as well. We love hearing from our listeners. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on YouTube. And of course, now you can listen on the new Family Life app. Family Life Blended is the leading resource ministry for stepfamilies around the world. If you're not familiar with us, we have the largest collection of articles and videos and resources for blended families, including my Smart Step Family series of books. All of those are available at familylife.com. And if you're interested in helping others, we've got lots of resources and training to help with that, including the all-access pass to the Summit on Step Family Ministry. That's our annual equipping event for leaders. It's all available online, on demand. Just check the show notes to learn more. Now, before we're done, let's go back to that question I asked Stephanie and hear her response on an important distinction. Stephanie, you make a real distinction. You say AS is not itself a, quote, gift, but the person with AS is a gift. Why is that distinction important?
It goes back to basic in my theology, whether a person has Downs or a physical disability or is going through cancer or neurotypical, we are all created equal and we are all made in God's image. So first of all, we need to treat everyone, no matter what the difference is, especially in this day and time with where we're at in the world. This person, no matter what their difference is for me, they are made in the image of God, and how I treat them should reflect how I would treat God himself and this person as a fellow member of the same creation. And so if the person in personhood is a gift, because I believe, I'm sure as you do, that there was a purpose and calling for every person made. God knew them in the womb. So that person is a gift. We treat them as a gift. And we understand that some people come with challenges. And so in that, looking at the person as a gift, it is also my gift to them, to understand them, to want to relate with them, to become a part of their world without the expectation of what they're going to do for me. Because sometimes it's not very rewarding being a parent or step-parent to a child on the spectrum, except for knowing you're doing the right thing. You're doing everything you can for that person, and you're stewarding the gift that God gave you, and that you're going to do everything you can for the potential level of that child, whether it's going away to college or being able to work at a supermarket but still has to live with you. Whatever the potential is, find the potential for that person and celebrate whatever it is.
Next time, we'll hear from authors and educators Craig and Gina Morgan about the blended family lessons they've learned from the School of Hard Knocks.
We actually went to Houston to see you at a weekend conference, and light bulbs were going off left and right. And I thought, oh my goodness, I wish I'd known all this years ago.
And I don't even think I wanted to go with him to that.
That's Craig and Gina Morgan next time on Family Life Blended. I'm Ron Deal. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our Family Life Legacy partners for making this podcast possible. You too can support this podcast and other resources that we make at Family Life by making a tax-deductible donation specifically for Family Life Blended by going to familylife.com/blendedpodcast and clicking the donate button. If you become a monthly partner, we'll send you a gift card to our Weekend to Remember Marriage Conference held throughout the U.S. and Canada. Our chief audio engineer is Keith Lynch, Bruce Goff, our producer, mastering engineer is Justin Adams, and theme music provided by Braden Deal. Family Life Blended is produced by Family Life and is part of the Family Life Podcast Network.